Hey everyone, welcome to the Front Stretch Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. Now this week I'm joined by my colleague at Front Stretch, Mike Neff, to talk some short track racing at Martinsville Speedway, before digging deep into the 2020 schedule that NASCAR released on Tuesday. And then, Ty Dillon calls in to discuss his strong performance at the Paperclip and solid start to the 2019 year with Germain Racing, as well as his take on the 2020 schedule. But before we get started, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the Front Stretch Podcast, as those ratings help us out tremendously. Now let's talk some racing with Neff. All right, Neff, we got a lot to talk about this week, but first let's talk about Martinsville. You were there. You saw Brad Keselowski destroy the field, leading 446 laps. Initially, what are your thoughts on it?
I mean, I understand that he destroyed the field, and everybody's talking about it being such a dominating performance, but it didn't really feel like it. I mean, I've been there before when there's been – I saw Joey Logano pretty much run away with it a couple, 3 years ago, and for the whole day, you just knew that it was his to lose. But this one, it felt like – it always felt like Keselowski was just kind of there, but somebody else was going to show up and take it from him. And especially Elliott, because Elliott's car was extremely fast, and yeah, it just didn't work out that way. But in the end, yeah, I mean, were it not for Elliott taking the lead there in that one little stretch, he would have probably set the record for the most laps led at Martinsville, because it was and Brad was pointed out, too, it was a total team effort. Because the pit crew got him out first every time that he came in, or got him out ahead of where he came in, or equal to where he came in every time. And they made some adjustments throughout the day, although they were small. And I didn't get a chance to ask Paul Wolf after the race, because he made a comment as Brad was, like, cooling down for the victory lap that he needed to let him know ahead of time if he needed to be loosened up. And I don't know if that was kind of tongue-in-cheek because Brad seemed to be pretty tight on that final run. But Paul was just saying in the post-race that he was really worried about taking too big of a swing because the car was so good. And that's the challenge you face all the time, is you take a big swing and you go too far and you knock yourself out of something. And again, one of the things that I still like about this year, too, and I talked about it in post-race, too, is getting rid of the track bar adjuster.
Right.
I mean, that was kind of a cool thing, but I really like the fact that you have put a little more pressure back on the driver, and you're making the driver mid-race have to make adjustments in their driving style and the way they attack the track in order to accommodate while the car has to swing to where it's good at the end.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you hit on a lot of things there. But, man, Brad Keselowski really did dominate the race. 446 laps, as I said. I think it was 89%. I looked it up. It's not the highest percentage he's ever led in a cup race, though. Back in 2014 at Richmond, he led 95% of the race, 383 of 400 laps. But, I don't know, it's very rare to see a driver dominate, you know, to this degree, especially at Martinsville. I mean, 400 laps, I'd say, is a, you know, a pretty high number.
It's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. The last time that happened was Jeff Gordon 22 years ago. But the last couple of years, I mean, we've seen Joey Logano last year in the playoffs. I think he led 309 laps. It was over 300. Clint Boyer led the final 215 laps of last spring's race. So once a driver gets out front, obviously has a good car. At Martinsville, I mean, they can pull away. But like you said, Brad didn't really pull away. The second place car was always within, I don't know, half a second to a second pretty much the entire race. And there's only seven cautions, so 19 cars finished on the lead lap, which was also kind of a surprise. Or 20 cars finished on the lead lap, so more than half the field, because there's only 36 cars. Yeah, that was just an interesting race to me, because...
Yeah, and I agree on that it was almost a little disappointing from Martinsville standards that you really didn't have a massive pile of sheet metal in the garage at the end of the day. You know, even on races before that I've been there where you only had four or five caution flags, you still had guys that used each other up and tore fenders off of cars and everything. So at the end of the day, there would be a big pile in the garage that people would cut off before they would load their cars in. And with really... there were a lot of cars after that race that looked like they had been in a race at you know, at Charlotte on the Oval or something, where there was just almost no crinkles in them at all. And that's just really strange for Martinsville. And that's, again, we've talked about this new car, and it's going to change with the Gen 7 next year, so we'll see what it does. But this one, it just honestly seems like it's, we've gone back to a car that's really hard to spin out. And so you had guys who were doing bump and runs all day long. And if you were back watching the racing in the field, there were guys getting moved constantly. But it never really, like, got them out of shape. People would get in somebody's back bumper and just sail them into the corner, and a person would just kind of drift up a lane and a half and turn right back down and keep going. And I think that it's still a matter of this thing is pushed down into the ground so hard that it's almost impossible to spin these things out.
Yeah, I mean, almost immediately after the race, Dale Jr. went to Twitter and said, dominating a short track like that is one of the most impressive performances you'll see in today's NASCAR. And I agree with that because, as we mentioned, 446 laps, I mean, that's no joke. But, I mean, I'm like you. You know, usually you see a lot of carnage in Martinsville, at least more than seven cautions. But the three lead changes is crazy. But I didn't think it was that, I mean, it wasn't a great race, but it wasn't a bad race either.
No, the race itself was really entertaining. And as I said, if you were there in person, the racing back in a pack was bananas. Right. There was two and three wide racing. And that was something, too, that I think we've seen it for a couple of years. And again, maybe because a car is down in the track so hard. But, and it's kind of ironic that I'm saying this, because people were making moves on the outside.
Yeah.
And the outside lane was working. But funny that one of the people that seemed to do that quite a bit was Kyle Busch. And his complaint all day long was that they could not get the car in the track, that he felt like he was on top of the track and skating around the whole time. And I was honestly surprised, because I generally like to listen to Kyle's radio just because he diagnoses a race from beginning to end and what his car needs and really gets to the nitty-gritty of making the car fast. And for the last 200 laps and the last two or three pit stops, he didn't have anything to say. He was kind of like, you know, it's loose in, a little tight in the middle, but it gets to where it's not bad in the middle, and there's nothing that he wanted to really change. And so the last two pit stops, it was interesting to hear the crew chief's like, okay, well, what do you need in there? And he'd be like, Gatorade and ice, or water and ice. And I don't know, I couldn't see the pit from where I was, so I don't know if they were making any changes or not. But he was really frustrated because it felt like they tried to chase stuff all day long, and when it got near the end, he just kind of gave up, because no matter what they did, the car kept doing the same thing.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, using that outside line, and that's something that Chase Elliott did in the closing laps, really, and he started to pull away from Kyle in a few more laps. Brad said he thought Chase had a better car at the end. Chase got within, I think, 3/10 at the checkered flag, or it was a half a second. He got within 3/10 on the final lap, and
he was way closer than that going into three.
Yeah, and he said straight up that, you know, if he got to him, he wasn't afraid to use the bumper. I mean, that's the only way he's going to pass on the final lap.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, like you said, using that, he was almost diamond in the corner, and I saw on Twitter after the race, I think it was him and Ty Majeski, who's, you know, a great short track racer. It's kind of like a line they use at the Snowball Derby down in Florida. But yeah, that is interesting how that kind of paid off for him. Maybe should have went up there sooner. Maybe that's the only one regret he has.
Yeah, it could be. He, on the last lap, he sailed it into three. I honestly think if he had gotten to Keselowski, it probably would have been Kyle Busch that won the race, because he was going so hard into three that if he had hit Brad, I think it probably would have wiped both of them out. But because he ended up washing, gosh, probably 2.5 lanes up in the middle of the corner, because he went in so deep, just trying to see if he could get any kind of contact with Brad, but Brad was clear enough of him. But yeah, it was, as Martinsville goes, it was a unique race. But it's still Martinsville. Gotta love that place. And I hope we continue to go there two times a year forever. And I hope we never run there at night, but I'm sure that's coming.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a little bit, because next year they are. Neff, what do you think this win does for Keselowski? Because, you know, this is his second win this year. Joining Kyle Busch is the only multi-time winners in six races. But he's won like 5 out of the last 16 races or 17 races dating back to, when was it? His first win at Darlington last year. So he's on a little bit of a roll, and he's kind of just goes under the radar and just methodically, you know, finishes top 5, top 10, and then dominates races.
Yeah, he's, I mean, I've always appreciated Brad because I feel like he's one of the personalities in the sport.
Yes.
And he will say what's on his mind, but it's very calculated. He takes the time to think about responses before he says things. And you know when it comes out of his mouth, it's not knee-jerk, that he has really put thought into it before he says something. And he'll admit last year when they went on that stretch where they won 3 races in a row that they weren't really the best car over those 3. It just kind of worked out that way. And he repeatedly said it Sunday that he didn't think he was the best car Sunday, that he thought Elliott was a better car, but he felt like he learned that little bit that Chase was in front of him, that he learned some things off of what Chase was doing, and that helped him once he got back in front of him. So the fact that the thing that I think is kind of lost on people about Brad is that he's got that kind of aw shucks personality to him, but I honestly think he is one of the smartest guys in the garage. And I think that that's one of the things that a lot of people mistake about him is because of that kind of personality that he has. They don't realize just how observant he is, how on top of everything he is, and how much he thinks out every single thing that goes on whenever he's in a race.
Yeah, I really can't add too much to that. As you said, very calculated. He's very outspoken, and he's been that way his whole career, really. And that's stuff that we can appreciate. I mean, we like getting those quotes, whether it's from him.
We love that.
Yeah, yeah. Whether it's from him or Kyle or whoever. I don't know, but I do want to compare because now we're 6 races in, a sixth of the way through the year. Obviously, there's a lot of time left in the season still, 8 months. but it's Team Penske versus Joe Gibbs Racing right now, Neff. Who do you give the edge to?
I mean, if I'm picking it right now, I got to feel like Penske is.
Same.
I mean, guys, if you look at it, Penske's consistently got 2 and 3 cars up there running around the front of the pack, where the Joe Gibbs gang, I mean, Eric Jones was a non-factor on Sunday, really. I mean, I think he ended up in top 10, top 8, something like that, but he was never
He was there, and then he crashed. He finished 30th.
Oh, gotcha. But he was around, but it wasn't like he was running, mixing it up for the lead. At least, I don't remember him being that way.
No.
And Denny, same way. You know, Denny goes to Martinsville. You expect him to be in the mix. And he was there early, but it felt like they kind of just never made gains, that they had what they had and they kind of stayed there the whole race. And so that was weird. And Truex, you know, it's one of those things. I think Truex has got some potential there. He's obviously got potential there, but I think he's got the potential that they're still in that feeling out process where they're going to have a race or two where they're on and a race or two where they're off. But by the time we get to Daytona in July, I think they're going to be in the mix as well. But yeah, I'm with you. Right now, it's Penske and Gibbs and everybody else. And it looks like Richard Childress Racing has figured out qualifying, but the races aren't coming together for him. And Hendrick has figured out first practice, and then they just suck from there on out. And everybody else is just kind of there.
Yeah, and you hit on Stuart Haas there, and obviously, you know, they won 12 races last year. They all finished in the top 10 this week, but all in the back half of the top 10. So that, you know, that's not good, but you know, Clint Bowyer came back from 2 speeding penalties to get 7th. You had Denny Hamlin, like you said, he just kind of ran there all day. He came back from a speeding penalty at 5th. But yeah, it's Penske versus Gibbs right now, and like you said, just everybody else.
Yeah, I agree. The Stuart Haas guys, I mean, obviously they're still there. They're finishing top 10-ish. But they're just not in that dominating performance like they were last year. They're just that little bit off, still figuring out. I mean, it's a new package. And we talked about this before the season started, that somebody was going to get it early. They would go off and run away and win a bunch of races where everybody else caught up to them. And by the time we got to the end of regular season, they'd all be mixing it up. Right now, it looks like it's Penske and half of Joe Gibbs that have got it figured out. I think we're still going to see Ganassi Racing put together some wins. I feel like Kurt's going to win two or three races this year. We know Larson will come around and win at Michigan at least once. So we're going to see other cars up there. But yeah, at this point, taking a snapshot right now, it is Team Penske and half of Team Gibbs, and everybody else is sitting there with their hats out begging for scraps.
Yeah, and like Harvick's still running well. He's top five in points. Almirola is sixth in points, and he might be finishing, you know, primarily like sixth through tenth, but he's off to an incredible start to the year. Best start by far he's ever been off to. Five straight top tens, which is a career long for him. Daniel Suarez for Stuart Haas. You know, just like Truex, there's going to be some adjustment. They're going to be feeling out each other still. But he's got two top tens now, finishing 10th at Martinsville. So there's definitely potential for other teams, other drivers. Like you said, Ganassi, I like them this year, especially Kurt in the one car. So there's definitely potential for these other drivers to step up their game or other teams. But Neff, you hit on this a little bit earlier about how one team in particular, you know, they have speed and then maybe they suck. Your words, not mine. But what the hell was going on Sunday with Jimmy Johnson?
Whoa. I really don't know. I mean, that was one of those things. I mean, there were people talking about it at the track, whether they're in the media center, out in the infield or whatever, that, I mean, it's like Dover, you know, they can be god awful everywhere else. But when they show up at Dover and Martinsville, you know, no matter what, Jimmy Johnson is going to be in the mix. And they were so far out of the mix, it wasn't funny. And it was all day. It wasn't like they were in it and then something maybe broke on a car and so it cost them. They were not there at the beginning and they were still not there at the end. And that was truly shocking to me. Because when you're dealing with, you know, Bristol and Martinsville especially, there's a feel to the car. The drivers know what that feel is. They know how to set it up for it. And whatever the aero package is, that feel is still there and you still set it up the same way. And it feels like whatever Hendrick's got going on in their setup area is completely out to lunch because they were horrendous on Sunday.
Yeah, outside of Chase, obviously. But yeah, even like, you know, Bowman ran, I don't know, 11th to 20th pretty much the whole day. Byron got spun out by Ty Dillon early in the race, or I guess in the middle of the race. And Jimmy, I mean, he was running okay at the beginning. He started, 11th? He was running okay and then just kept dropping back, just like he has been kind of all year. You know, they might get stage points in the first or second stage, but then they can't get the finish. But on Sunday, man, he was just in the way. He got lapped three separate times. Finished two laps down, took the wave around once to get one of the laps back. That's just, I mean, Martinsville, you think of Martinsville.
Unreal.
Yeah, you think of Martinsville and short tracks, they kind of even the playing field a little bit. And even if you're off, like a Hendrick, I don't know, because you look at, just look at Chase. I mean, he finished second and led 49 laps and legitimately had a shot to win. And then compare that to his teammate who finished 24th and was a non-factor all day, who's the master of Martinsville. I don't know. I don't really have any words.
Yeah, like I said, it's dumbfounding. And at that point, I mean, how do you blow it all up? You know, do we go to complete scratch and start over? What do we do there? Because there's got to be something going on somewhere in their process that is not working, at least not working for the 48 and the 24. I mean, those two teams just seem to be really struggling. Bowman has his moments, and Chase is obviously getting the best guy out of the group. But I don't know, man. They've been the flagship for this sport for so long.
Yeah.
And we're going on year three, if not four, of them really struggling. And they spend an awful lot of money to be that bad.
Yeah.
And I got to think Mr. H is getting tired of it.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I would say 4 years, because even though he won the championship in 2016, leading in the playoffs wasn't very good for him.
Yeah, I mean, he won three races real early in the season, and then they went to hell and they were bad up until really the second round of the playoffs that year.
Yeah.
And then they finally kind of got rolling.
Yeah, and honestly, since 2016, the year he won at Martinsville to lock himself into Homestead, he hasn't finished in the top 10 since that Martinsville race. So that's five straight races now outside the top 10 with a best finish of 12th. You know, 5 years ago, 2016, like we said, he had a bad year, but won at Martinsville. 3 years ago, he could have drove a tanker on Martinsville and still been a factor. The other day, he just was in the way. Just something we're not accustomed to seeing. But I think we thought there'd be some kind of adjustment with Kevin Mendering coming over as the crew chief. But I don't know, man. This is it's kind of I'm dumbfounded too. I don't know how to describe it. You can't describe it.
No, you can't. It's just a matter of you sit there and attack it however you can and try to claw your way through it. But man alive, it is something that none of us have expected, I tell you that.
All right, Neff, we've been recording for about 20 minutes now. Do you have any other thoughts on the Cup race? Because we got to get in the schedule. That came out as we're recording Tuesday about an hour ago. A ton of changes. Or we can talk a little bit about the truck race. That was kind of a good race until Kyle Busch took over.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to call out the fans a little bit because the stands were pretty sparse at Martinsville. And we've only got, depending on your definition of a short track, 6 or 10 short or 11 short tracks on the schedule. So if we want those to stick around, we got to be showing up. And the weather was beautiful on Sunday. It's close enough to some major metropolitan areas that we need to be getting the stands completely filled up there, or we're going to end up being down to one race at Martinsville. And God, I do not want to see that happen.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely won't happen next year because they got two on the schedule still, and as they would with all the tracks, with the track agreement. But, you know, the big thing is that I saw a report come out, I think it was Sunday morning, maybe Saturday, that Martinsville expected an increase in fans throughout the weekend because, I mean, just think of the last couple of years. Martinsville's had some really shitty weather. With the snow out last year, the last spring race. The fall race wasn't too bad. But there's been rain, like I said, snow. I mean, it sucks. And when you look at it, I mean, the middle of March, late March, not a good time. I mean, Virginia's in, I guess you could call it the South, but it's, I don't know, snow obviously still hits it. But then October, I mean, all along until you get to really North Carolina, South Carolina, just geographically, it shouldn't be late October, in my opinion. But that's going to change next year, too, because it's even later in the season. Yeah, so I don't know. When I saw that report, I was optimistic that, you know, the stands are going to be full. There's, 45,000 stands? There's not that many stands there. So when you see that on TV, the openness, not good.
Yeah, it seats, I don't remember officially. I want to say it's like 63 and change.
Maybe maybe said they were expecting 45, which maybe they did then. Maybe they got that.
Yeah, if that's what they were expecting, I would say that's close. It was a little over half full, if I had to guess. So, yeah, somewhere in the 35 to 40 range is probably where they were at. But, again, there's no reason that race should not be sold out. It's right. One of the best states on the entire schedule, and there's fans are to blame. You know, we have everybody talking about bring back Rockingham. The reason we're not at Rockingham is because the fans didn't show up.
Right.
And so if you don't show up at Martinsville, you're going to lose it too.
Unfortunately. Now, I guess we can dive into the schedule. You want to?
Yeah. That sounds like a great idea.
All right. We talked a little bit off air before we recorded. But Neff, a ton of changes next year. Some that we like, some that we don't like, some that we might differ in opinions about. The end goal is obviously, you know, to bring more people out to the track, like we were just talking about. And I mean, a lot of that, NASCAR's definitely taking a step, and this could only be a 1 year switch, or maybe it won't be. With 2021 supposed to be in the key year of adding all these new dates on the track and places and tracks and whatever. We're going to talk about 2020. Obviously, Daytona 500 is going to be the first race of the year. However, there have been rumors that maybe in the future it won't be. That'll be interesting. But right after Daytona, we're going out west. So we're moving Atlanta back. We're going to Vegas, Auto Club, and Phoenix. Thoughts on moving the West Coast swing up a week, I guess, essentially, and moving Atlanta back to the fifth race?
I mean, I think that's fine. I feel like Atlanta in February was still cold, and you've given them some really crappy weather for their races, similar to Rockingham and Martinsville for a very long time. And it's nice to give them a little break on weather to where they're at least in the middle of March now instead of the mid to late February. In all honesty, I would have liked to see them make it a true West Coast swing and move Atlanta even two dates further back and put Texas after Phoenix. And so you knocked out four West Coast races in a row. But let me start out by saying anything that we bash on this, we still appreciate that they're trying. And we're trying to make some changes, and we're trying to do some different things. I was lucky enough to see Steve Phelps walking around on pit lane on Sunday, and I told him straight up, I said, I support you. I appreciate that you are trying to shake some things up. I know you're getting pushback from everybody and their brother on different things because people are always resistant to change. But I love the fact that he's trying, and we're trying to do something different because we're trying to save this sport. Oh, yeah. And however we're going about it, I'm supporting them on it because something had to change. And they've made some changes this time. Next time, now that the next year is the end of the 5-year contracts that they had signed, will really shake things up, we hope. I guess we'll find out. I'm willing to bet that, and we'll talk about this whole schedule if you want, but a little bit later in the schedule than where we're talking at right now, we actually have two races on back-to-back days at one track. And I'm wondering if that's kind of a trial balloon for some of these other tracks that have two dates so that we can double up at those tracks and then add some other tracks on those dates that ultimately get opened up.
Yeah, and we've seen it in other series like IndyCar, and it's worked out like the Belle Isle in Detroit. They've run it it's the week after the Indy 500 pretty much every year, to my knowledge. And they always have, and it seems like it's worked out. We'll get into that in a little bit. The races I just went over, the West Coast swing, that's a minor change. Because
I think the flip-flop to Phoenix being after Auto Club, I don't know that really makes any real difference. I do like that Atlanta's got a little bit warmer weather.
Yep.
And then the one after that is the one I was truly surprised at.
Yeah, so let's dig into this, Neff. So we might as well, I mean, NASCAR.com, they streamed it on Twitter, on all their social media platforms. Mike Helton was live from ISM Raceway in Phoenix. And they had an announcement
that was your first indication right there that something big was about to happen.
Correct. Now, ISM, which used to be the penultimate race of the year and, you know, decided the championship four, it was the cutoff in the third round of the playoffs, is now the final race of the season. That's where we're going to determine the championship in the three series. So with that, Homestead had to move. But Neff, Homestead is now the sixth race of the year and run in March. Now, in my opinion, I don't know, this is one of the changes I'm up in the air about. I'm looking forward to, I think they're trying to figure out how to phrase this, because drivers have wanted the last race to move around. I think fans did too. And I think media did too. ISM has provided some good races, especially recently. The spring race this year, just a couple weeks ago, wasn't the best Phoenix race. But Homestead usually puts on a good show, Neff. Last year, and we talked about this a lot, you know, the championship drivers finished 1-4. Now we look at Phoenix. Kevin Harvick's going to be the odds-on favorite if we get there, if he gets there. So what are your thoughts on Homestead moving all the way up to the sixth race of the year?
From a weather perspective, I think it's a great idea.
Sure.
You're going to be in South Florida in March when it's still chilly most everywhere else we're going. From that perspective, I think it's a good thing. I mean, if you were going to take the championship away from Homestead, I think moving it up early in the year is a smart move, again, because of the weather factor. Other than that, I'm kind of shocked that they decided on Phoenix. But again, like you said, the drivers have been wanting to move around. I'm assuming that this is just the first salvo and moving it around quite a bit. But yeah, Homestead jumping all the way to the front of the schedule is similar to Atlanta. You know, Atlanta was around Labor Day and late in the schedule for several years when they went to one race, and now they've been moved to the front. So maybe that's the new methodology of things, as we move you from the back to the front. So I think from a weather standpoint, I think it's good. Competition-wise, I'm kind of indifferent. I think it's going to be a good show. Phoenix, like you said, if Harvick gets things figured out with this car, that could be a real runaway for several years.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Kyle Busch has been strong there of late, so who knows? Maybe we're lining things up for Kyle to go on a 5 or 6 championship run.
For sure, and obviously you got to get, I mean, there's a lot that goes into the schedule change, obviously, more than we know. It's not like you just pick a date and be like, oh, we're moving here. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that. And they had,
I mean, if you want to just wrap your head around something, last year, in 2017, I don't remember 2018 number, but in 2017, Charlotte Motor Speedway, the complex, had 400 unique events take place on the schedule.
Jeez.
There's 365 days in a year. So you can do the math on that yourself. And we saw it last year during the 600. They had the Miss Hooters pageant on Z-Max Dragway after the racing went on Saturday. So you get a couple things on certain days. But the fact that you've got contracts and agreements with a myriad of different places that are all using these facilities, and now you want to all of a sudden take a date and move it 2 or 3 months later, there's a bunch of balls in the air at the same time. And then you're not only dealing with that, but you're dealing with 3 different national touring series and sponsor commitments. And also, I mean, it's bananas what goes into trying to set this schedule. So, I mean, I give NASCAR credit for, as sweeping as these changes are, they had to talk to a lot of people and make a lot of adjustments and commitments to make this thing work.
Yeah, for sure. And unfortunately for Homestead, they don't even get a playoff race. They've been the season finale for like 17, 18 years now. And always usually provides a good, decent race, at least at the very minimum. That was kind of a double whammy. We hit on Homestead and we hit on Phoenix closing the year out. Neff, the next big change that I see is Martinsville. Now, we just went there, obviously, in the end of March. Now, that race is getting replaced by Homestead, ironically. And Martinsville's moving down to Mother's Day weekend on Saturday, May 9th, under the lights. So the first race in, what, 70 years that it's been in operation, it's going to be under the lights. I can tell that you're not in favor of this. But there's a reason they added lights, I mean, a few years back. And I don't know. I like the idea, honestly.
Okay, first of all, Bristol got moved back slightly, too.
Sure.
It's now in April. So, less chance of snow in Bristol, which is a good thing. The Martinsville thing, it's on Mother's Day weekend, so I understand they're not going to run on Sunday.
Better weather.
We never run on Sunday Martinsville, or never run on Sunday Mother's Day. Definitely better weather, so happy about that. When they put out the release that lights were being added to Martinsville, it was highlighted that it was for a quote-unquote insurance policy because they had races that had run late and they wanted to make sure they would be able to run full distance. So they put the lights in as a catch-all to maybe finish some races under the lights if they ran a little long from accidents and what have you. Anybody with a lick of sense knew that that was a complete line of crap and that eventually this day was coming. But for those of us that are Martinsville purists and hate the fact that we have lights and knew this day was coming, we now hate it even worse because the day has finally gotten here. Again, I'm with you. The weather is better. I love the fact that we're in May in Martinsville. I think it's going to be a much nicer weather and just a nicer time of year. I think the whole experience will be better. But I hate the fact that we're running at night. Hate it.
Yeah, I'm open to it.
That's because you're a millennial. That's how this whole thing works. The millennials like new stuff. Old farts like me hate it.
And that could be part of it. I don't know. I think
I guarantee it's part of it. Completely agree.
But
I know I'm in a minority.
I don't know. I just don't see. I think they should. They can try something. I mean, if it doesn't work out, then 2021 they go back to Sunday. You know, who cares? Martinsville, like you said, the fans didn't come out this weekend, but it's been on the circuit since NASCAR's been a thing.
They spend $35 million or something on lights. Yeah, they ain't going back to daytime, brother. They told us why they put it in, but we know the real deal.
For sure.
They would not put those in for a $35 million insurance policy. It was in there so we could run our night.
And for now sure. We're good.
And you know, we haven't got the other ancillary schedules yet, but you know they're going to run trucks on Friday night. So you're going to get two night races out of the deal.
Correct. Now, the race that's replacing is Kansas, which is really, you know, minimal change for Kansas, just going back to the end of the month, end of May, after 2 weeks in Charlotte. So the All-Star race will remain in Charlotte next year. But now we're moving down here. Neff, we go to Sonoma, Chicagoland. But then at the end of June, the end of June and the beginning of July is, I don't know, this could go one of two ways. It could be really good or really bad, because as we are talking offline, obviously they're going to Pocono Saturday, June 27th and Sunday, June 28th for two cup races. Now, I'd imagine, you know, like we said, the other series schedule hasn't come out, won't come out probably for a while, but I imagine they're also going to be racing at Pocono that weekend as well. But Neff, we got a doubleheader at Pocono. To my knowledge, I've never seen anything like this before in the Cup Series. What are your initial thoughts on it? And it being Pocono.
I mean, I think it's cool. Like I said earlier in the podcast, I think this is a trial balloon.
Yes.
That we're running up here to see some places like, I don't know, Kansas, where there's some people in the business that don't particularly enjoy the trip to Kansas, to where if we knocked them out on back-to-back days, that could be a good thing. I think it's cool. I like the idea. I like the fact that you're trying it at Pocono, where for the most part, you don't get a lot of damage to race cars. So hopefully, you know, if somebody gets a car torn up, they only get one torn up over the weekend, and it doesn't really put them behind. But that's my one worry about this, is we run back-to-back at Pocono, and the very next weekend we go to Indianapolis. So you've got basically three races in 8 days that technically or theoretically can use the same car, because the 2.5-mile car is pretty much what these guys want to use. And most of them, even back when we used to have Indy the weekend after Pocono, you took the Indy car as your backup to Pocono. And, you know, you hoped that you wouldn't necessarily have to bust them out. But if you did, you did. Then you had another one that you could bring up. But three races in 8 days, it would worry me that if somebody has a bad day on Friday and wrecks a car in practice, and then Sunday they wreck another car in the second Pocono race, now you're going to Indy and you've torn up two 2.5-mile cars. Have they got another two to take to Indy? If they just, I worry that it's going to put a burden on these teams that is a little unnecessary. But I'm completely on board. I like the doubleheader idea. And I think, in all honesty, when these other schedules come out, this could be a massive racing weekend.
Yeah.
If they decide to bring ARCA in too, you could end up having ARCA run on Friday with trucks, and then Saturday be Cups and Xfinity, and finish it up with Cup on Sunday. I think it could be a really cool deal.
And also, ARCA's been at, you know, they go to Pocono twice per year usually. So this is going to affect other racing series, not just the top three that we know, you know, of. But Pocono, man, I'm probably in the minority here, but a lot of my childhood, I went to Pocono as a fan.
I'm in the minority, too. I love Pocono.
Yeah.
I think Pocono is one of the most challenging tracks that we go to because of its unique shape and the fact that it requires teams to make a compromise. They will tell you that it's like physically impossible to make a car that is good in all three corners.
Yeah.
So they have to make a concessions to get any kind of speed there. And I love that aspect of that race. I've always been a big fan of Pocono.
Yeah, like you said, the three corners are so unique from each other, much different, shaped after a couple different tracks, whether it's Pocono, Nazareth, or there's one more. Yep, Indy.
Turn two is supposed to be after Indy.
Correct.
It's three different tracks.
Yes. One's a track that used to run in New Jersey, I believe. But regardless, Pocono's, in my opinion, it's a good track. Since it's gone to 400 miles, which is about 8-9 years ago now, the racing's gotten quite a bit better. But I'm curious, you know, it's a doubleheader, but I'm curious as to if each race is going to be 400 miles. That's something that hasn't come out yet and might not for a while. It might be something that NASCAR and in Pocono, it can almost be like a test dummy or some sort with shorter races. And with having
longer races,
there's that too. I mean, it could be.
That's not going to happen, dude. I know I am in the extremely small minority of that group that wants longer races.
Yeah, I mean, but I could see maybe going down to 350. I don't know.
I could too easily, especially the Saturday race
for sure. But then, as you mentioned, if we go to Indy, July 4th weekend. Now, this is going to piss off a lot of NASCAR and racing purists. Probably you, someone that's followed the history of the sport forever. I mean, even me, I'm not pissed off about it, of them moving out of Daytona, but going to Indy in the beginning of July, you grew up in Indy. It's going to be hot, very hot.
It's real hot. Absolutely going to be real hot. But it's always hot in August, too, and we've been going there in August forever. So Indianapolis is ridiculously hot from early to mid-June till the end of August. It always is, always will be. I'm with you a little bit on this. I would probably be more upset if it was truly July 4th. If Daytona had stayed on July 4th all these years and they moved it off of it and put Indy on July 4th, I might be a little more upset. But, I mean, Daytona's been around July 4th for 20-something years, if not longer. So I'm kind of indifferent on it. I don't know that it bothers me that much that you're doing it, especially when you take a look at where they moved Daytona to. So I'm curious to see how it plays out. Again, we're shaking things up. Let's shake it up. And so I'm kind of indifferent. I do find it interesting that we're doing Indy and Kentucky back-to-back. I think that's a little challenging for Indy, because they've been struggling for fans for a while to begin with, and now you're putting them on top of the next closest race to them. So, you know, you had people that would come from Kentucky to go to Indy to see the race, but now in back-to-back weekends, I feel like it may put an even bigger hurt on the fan attendance at Indianapolis.
Yeah, I mean, it could, but I don't know. Like I said, I'm in favor of the change. Why not try something different? Although it is going to be very hot, which could be a concern for drivers, team members, fans. I mean, that alone could, you know, not make fans want to go to the track. I know when I covered a race at Richmond a couple of years ago in 2017, the April race, and it was 90, 95 and above the whole weekend. And of course, attendance is going to be, you know, it's going to be affected when something like that happens and the weather is so hot. And you know, NASCAR can control a lot of things, but they can't control Mother Nature. So,
nope.
Mother Nature always wins. It always will, always has. So yeah, that is a concern though for me that I have for Indy. But now Daytona, that moved to the end of August, and it's the last race of the regular season. So now, you know, drivers have that. It's like a last chance race. You can't get it done in the first 25 to make the playoffs. Well, here you go. Here's your shot, Daytona. Being a plate track, although they're not using restrictor plates next year, or even at Talladega this year. So what are your thoughts on moving Daytona to the last race of the regular season?
I don't know. I'm supportive of the changes and trying something different. I know you're going to have some people screaming and hollering because it's such a crapshoot race. But at the same time, I kind of like that. I think you're getting a chance in that last Hail Mary moment before the playoffs where somebody that you don't expect to grab a win can get a win and make that round. And it may happen, it may not. You know, I'm still, and I already feel like this year's going to be a lost cause on it, I'm still holding out hope that one of these years we have 17 different people win races and somebody with a win doesn't make the playoffs. But at this point, I'm already feeling like this year's going to be lost on that front because I feel like Kyle and Brad are each going to win 5 or 6 each. So we will see. But I'm kind of curious about it. Again, it's on a Saturday, which means they're probably going to run at night. And I'm not a fan of night races in Daytona in the summer because anybody that's been around Florida in the summer knows it rains every single day. And the reason we used to start at 11 o'clock on the 4th of July was so that we were done before it rained. And I wish we would get back to that, but they don't want to have people sitting in the sun, so we have to deal with rain. But it's going to be neat. I mean, I like the Hail Mary aspect of it. I like the and we see that as we go through the playoffs here. The elimination races in the playoffs all seem to be kind of set up that way. Yep. That mayhem could ensue.
Yeah, and I mean, I kind of gave my take on Daytona, but another change worth noting is Dover, being a playoff race since the playoffs began, is now the second Dover race, has moved up to the 25th race of the year, right before Daytona. That kind of sucks for Dover, that they're having two races during the regular season. But with the playoff lineup, I mean, let's move there. I'm in favor of the playoff lineup. I like it quite a bit, actually. We're starting off with the Southern 500, Neff. It's the playoff race now at Darlington Raceway. And then the other race in the first round are Richmond, which has been there, was there last year. And then also Bristol. That's a big change, I think, in my opinion. Moving Bristol back essentially 2 or 3 weeks on the overall calendar schedule. But 3 or 4 races back in the, you know, in the racing schedule. And now a playoff race, the Bristol night race, that was the only Bristol race I ever went to was last year, the night race. And that's probably my favorite track now to cover a race.
Bristol's an interesting elimination race.
For sure.
Again, with the track adhesive stuff, are we still going to be using that? If we are, I like the racing that it provides. And again, I feel like, and it may be artificial. I understand that some things that we do, this is an entertainment business, and some things might feel artificial. But it seems like they picked these elimination races because of the mayhem that could happen. And we all know Bristol night race, tempers get to flaring, things can happen. And if you're looking at two drivers that need to make it to the next round and they're battling for seventh, and whichever one gets seventh moves on, you know, things could get crazy. And I fully believe that that's why they put this race in there, and I hope that that's what we get. I hope we get a bunch of people that are battling each other trying to make it to the next round. And I love the idea that it's Bristol because, you know, they play up the last great Coliseum. It's really going to be a coliseum now where we're going to have some gladiators going at it. So I like it. I think the weather will still be decent mid-September. We shouldn't be getting cold. We shouldn't have to worry about any snow-type stuff yet. We're going to save that for later in the playoffs.
Yeah, I hope not. Not in September, at least middle of September. I also, like I said, I like the change. Bristol's never been a playoff race. And as you said, the racing there over the past, you know, when they've put that VH1 compound or whatever the hell they call it down, the race has been pretty good. The August race last year was probably, not just because it's Bristol and the view from the press box is out of this world, but it was just a good, hard race. You had so many different guys lead, and, you know, we go there in a week and a half now this comes out for the first race of the year this year at the Bristol, and I'm sure it'll be a good race. I mean, I'm just a big fan of Bristol short track racing, obviously. We got a lot of short tracks in this playoff, Neff, but round two doesn't have a short track. However, it does have two wild cards, and Las Vegas has been a wild card too over the past couple of years. I mean, it kicked off the playoffs 2018, and there was a ton of crashes. It's like, who's going to make, you know, a mistake next among the playoff drivers? Now it kicks off the round of 12, and then you go to Talladega, and then you end it with the Roval. So, good luck to all the drivers.
Yeah, and we saw that last year. The Roval
was
a wild card race.
Correct, and it ended the first round, not the second round. So it's even later in the playoffs this year, which, I mean, I don't know. It just puts that much more pressure on the teams.
Yep, and I fully believe that's why they kept it at the end of a round, is that mayhem can ensue. And, you know, that second weekend in October always was kind of the Charlotte date, and yep. They kind of got away from it the last couple of years, so I'm kind of glad they've gotten back to that. I was one of the outspoken people that thought the Roval was going to be an abject disaster, and I've admitted and will continue to admit I was wrong. Loved it. Can't wait to see it again. And I feel like having it being an elimination race is going to ramp things up even more. And so I'm looking forward to that. I like that they don't have Talladega as an elimination race because, again, I think it's too much of a wild card to have people's playoff lives be hanging in the balance.
See,
so I like that you got a chance to recoup from that with one more race before you eliminate.
You think Talladega is more of a wild card than the Roval?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, at the Roval, we had Keselowski miss turn one, and how many cars were in that?
Quite a few.
Six, seven. You go to Talladega and somebody screws up in front of the field and you pull 22 cars into it.
Correct.
But I mean, it just, when things go bad at Talladega, they can go really bad. And you can get, I mean, we saw that with Kyle Busch the year he won 8 races. And he was riding around the back at Talladega trying to stay completely out of the way. He was in to the next round, no worries. And an incident happens. He's slowing down and gets run over from behind and gets knocked out of the playoffs.
Yeah. I mean, no, I'm not arguing those points.
I feel like Talladega, as wild cards go, is as wild as it can get.
And I do agree with you for the most part on that, but I don't know. We got one. We can only base the Roval off one real race. I mean,
right.
I mean, granted, 2 races because the Xfinity Series, but one Cup race, and the Xfinity race was kind of lackluster at best, but the Cup race had it all, especially at the end. Like you said, Keselowski missed heartburn turn one, and then Larson, the dramatic on the last lap with Johnson and Truex, Larson getting by Jeffrey Earnhardt, who stalled. I mean, I would say last year out of the 2 races, and like I said, you can only gauge the Roval off that one race because that's all we've had. The Roval was more a wild card last year than Talladega, but again, you can only base it off that one race because that's all we've had.
Yep.
So who knows? Maybe, I mean, a second year on the Roval, drivers are going to know it better. They're going to have it more down in terms of, you know, where to brake and whatnot, and where to shift. But I don't know. I think because of the way that first year went at the Roval, it'll never be a cutoff race, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't think so either, unless it goes for a stretch of like 15 years where it's just a parade.
Right.
And I don't picture that happening.
Right. Now let's move on here. Now if we're getting down towards the end of the schedule here.
Now it gets fun.
Yeah. Now we go Kansas to kick off the third round, and then Texas. Texas doesn't lose, you know, it just stays the same as it always has been. And then Martinsville moves from being the 7th race in the playoffs typically to the 9th race, the penultimate race of the year where we set the final 4.
So everybody that started reading the schedule and saw that the first Martinsville race got moved into May and put all of your insulated clothing and everything on eBay because you weren't going to use it anymore, go pull your ads down because it's going to be cold as hell in November in Martinsville.
I mean, but in theory, it only moves, this could be a big change. It only moves it back a week because the series ends a week earlier than typical.
True.
So it only really moves it back a week, but I mean, you never know what you're going to get in Southern Virginia November 1st.
Yeah, exactly. It's in the mountains.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be cold. So, yeah, and again, mayhem, like it. Think it's going to really add some excitement to that race. And I think you're going to have people get a little crazier than normal. As you just mentioned, I didn't even pay attention to the fact that the whole thing ends November 8th.
Yeah, a week earlier.
NASCAR, Those of us in the Myrtle Beach area greatly appreciate the fact that the Myrtle Beach 400 can now be attended by as many Cup guys as want to come race at Myrtle Beach as they can.
Yeah, so now I'm not sure when Thanksgiving falls next year, but it would be, I think, 2.5 weeks before Thanksgiving, which usually it's the week of, which is kind of crazy. It's been like that for years. So we also missed earlier that there's two off weeks back-to-back during the Olympics, July 26th and August 2nd. That's something that we've never had back-to-back Cup weeks off in a long time that I can recall.
I'm assuming with the Olympics is kind of an exception, so we'll let that slide. I truly hope that as this thing evolves, we move that to either right before the playoffs or right before the final weekend. Because I just really feel like when it's the peak of your sport and going to the playoffs or going to the championship should be that true focus moment. You know, the NFL takes a week off between the championship games and the Super Bowl. And that's because they want to build up as much hype as they can. And I would love to see us either have it between the races 9 and 10 in the playoffs or before the playoffs start so that we can truly build up that excitement.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I think it should probably be before the playoffs begin. Because like you said, the Super Bowl, yes, you have that one extra week. Now, football is obviously a lot shorter season than NASCAR, and I don't really mind that the schedule's so long. I mean, it's 36 races. I don't think we're really ever going to get away from that. Even in 2021, we might have, you know, it might be more condensed. It might get over or start later or end earlier, whatever, but I don't think it really ever go away from 36.
I'm thinking we're going to go to 40 or 42.
We could, because if they're talking about adding these races.
Back-to-back deals?
Yeah.
I'm down with it. Let's make it happen.
So, Neff, I'm going to kind of end it on this one then for the schedule talk. What is your favorite change of for next year?
Probably Martinsville going to Mother's Day. I think I really like that. I like, but I would have liked to see that be even later than it is.
Even though it's under the lights?
I like Martinsville on Mother's Day. The light part I don't like about it, but, you know, I'll keep my fingers crossed that God loves true fans so much that he'll rain it out on Saturday and watch it during the day on Sunday.
That'd be crazy.
I like it being in May just because it's warmer weather, and Martinsville has just had crappy weather dates. Just like Rockingham did forever. And yeah. I like that they've got a better weather date.
Yeah, I think I kind of spoiled mine earlier, but it's Pocono. I mean, I definitely can't recall the last time we saw a doubleheader in the same weekend at the same track, other than IndyCar or, you know, a different form of motorsports.
I mean, not for the Cup Series.
Correct, yeah.
And we've seen, you know, Xfinity and truck doubleheader type stuff, but from the Cup Series, absolutely not.
Right. And it's something worth trying for Pocono, because there's a lot of talk that, you know, maybe this track should lose a race, maybe Dover should lose a race, whatever, because they haven't put on the best. You know, a lot of people say that there's no reason going to track twice. Going once makes it more of an event, which I agree. And now you're going there once, but you have two races there.
Right.
So I think, like you said, I think that this could be a test session of sorts to, like you said, like a Kansas or Texas or tracks we go to twice. You know, not all of them, like Daytona or whatever, but a lot of them that maybe we could do two races in the same weekend moving forward at the same track.
And that then gives you openings in the schedule where you can go to South Boston or Hickory or, you know, Irwindale or wherever we're right. going to go if we start looking at going back to some short tracks.
Correct.
And again, that's where I said I'm all down with a 42 to 45 race schedule. I know the teams don't want to hear that, but it would be phenomenal if we went to, you know, to 8 or 10 short tracks, and I've been on board with that for a long time, running on a Wednesday night.
Yeah.
You know, put 4 or 5 of them on a Wednesday night, and you know, the logistics of it can get worked out relatively easy, whether we tech the cars at the cup race the week the weekend before or whatever, so we don't have to drag all of the equipment to the short track. But I feel like, and I know you're going to get the pushback from people that say they don't have the seating capacity and they don't have the infrastructure to handle all the hospitality. Guess what? It's about the racing. Forget about the hospitality for some 8 or 10 races and just make it about the racing. And if we've only got seats for 10,000 people, maybe it's $300 or $400 for a ticket.
But they'll fill up.
It's because you got the chance to be at South Boston and see a cup race.
Right.
Or you got to be at Irwindale and see a cup race where they seat 9 or 10,000 people.
Right.
That's the thing that I think we kind of lose sight of, is they have this vision in their head and we got to be able to seat 45, 55, 65,000 people and have the tents and all this stuff. I mean, I know you weren't in Martinsville this weekend, but you roll into Martinsville off the main road and you kind of take a right, and there's this stair step parking area that leads from the road down to the racetrack.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was there in October. I see
that.
It
used to be haulers, souvenir haulers, and the hospitality and all that stuff used to completely cover that hillside. There was like 4 or 5 haulers there, period. That whole hillside was so empty.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I don't know that hospitality is something that we need to focus on anymore. Yes, there should be some hospitality, but I feel like if you work it right, you end up having hospitality get spread out so that, you know, maybe Toyota only does every other weekend or every third weekend, and they're not hauling these things all over the country. It saves the sponsors money. It saves the team some money, and they still get the exposure that they want through different means.
Right. No, that all makes sense. And I think just like, you know, them trying to a doubleheader weekend in Pocono, maybe that's the next step, is doing weekday races. But that'd be 2021 at the earliest. Neff, yep. any final thoughts on the schedule before we kind of get out of here?
Thumbs up to Steve Phelps and everybody at NASCAR. We talked about it early in the podcast that there's so many moving parts to this thing, and they had to have hundreds, if not thousands, of people in on the discussions to make this thing come together. And the fact that it's March 26th and they were able to get this thing out, I give them kudos for that. I give them kudos for trying different things. I know some people get mad that they try to manufacture excitement. I like the way that they put the cutoff races that are at places where excitement can happen. And I think that it's going to add to the drama of the playoffs. And that's what we want. We want storylines. We want to be able to talk about stuff. So I give kudos to NASCAR about it. I love the fact that we're going to some different places a little later in the season to get us a little bit warmer weather in the Southeast. I'm a little shocked that Phoenix gets to be the final race. But as we've said, if we're going to mix this up every 2-3 years, I'm down with that.
Yeah, you mentioned excitement a lot. And so I'm excited to hear what Ty Dillon has to say about the schedule and also a 13th place finish this past weekend at Martinsville. All right, Ty, I feel like we have a lot to talk about over the next 10 to 15 minutes or so. But let's start with Martinsville, because you started 22nd, finished 13th. Overall, just take us through your weekend.
Yeah, it was a great weekend for us, and, you know, Martinsville's been a place that 2 years ago we went and had a test at the end of the season, and we learned a lot of stuff, and I learned a lot of stuff there as a driver to what I needed in a fast car, and ever since that test, we've just continued to grow on that, and at the end of the fall race last year, we ended up 15th, and that was probably our best overall run that we had as a team, and we've just been building momentum at all these short tracks every time we go back to them. On what I need as a fill, and we went to Phoenix this year and had success there as well, and I just feel like we're really building on our short track program at Terrain Racing, and Martinsville's been kind of the catalyst for that, to go out and finish 13th this weekend, and really probably should have ran inside the top 10, possibly top 5 as fast as we were. It was a great momentum boost. We've been having a solid year this year. We just got to keep this kind of momentum going on a mile and a half as well.
Yeah, that leads right into my next question about short tracks, because like you mentioned, two straight top 15s with the fall race last year also. Do you feel like you're starting to figure out the short tracks, particularly Martinsville?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the short tracks in cup racing are hard to get right away as a rookie. I did grow up as a short track racer on dirt, so I feel a little more comfortable there, but these guys are so good, you have to really step your level up, and now I'm starting to understand what our cars need to really excel there. And I think for our team, it's a great place to go out and show how much we've improved and show what we can do, and we've always done well at tracks where being, you know, using your smarts as a driver and saving your tires and not wearing out your brakes can always improve your finish. We've always done well there. And Martinsville's been kind of that style of place more and more we go back there. So anytime we get a long run racetrack, it's really helped us out.
Yeah, and I saw a quote from you after the race where you stated, I'm paraphrasing, that this is where you kind of envisioned 3 years ago when you made the move to Germain Racing, and you're getting better year after year. Now, the last time I spoke with you was at the Daytona 500 Media Day, and you seemed really confident about 2019. So how were you so optimistic heading into this year after, I guess, a tough past couple of years?
I think we just did a lot of good things as far as progressing our team this offseason. We moved a little closer to our CRO, and we're getting information quicker than what we have before. That we can just stay ahead of the game. We're not, you know, having to spend a whole day just traveling information. And being a day behind during the work week can put you a week behind or 2 weeks behind as far as racing goes. And we've just been able to get things that we need quicker. And I think all the guys at RCR and Germain Racing have worked really well together. But all the guys back at the shop at Germain Racing have put in so much time and so many hours with the shop move. And they've all stepped up. Everybody wants to run better. And Matt Borland's got a second year under his belt leading Germain Racing. And it's showing. And him and I's relationship, I think, was a big step, too. Him and I spent a lot of time this offseason going to lunch, just getting to know each other. And we're still doing that. We're just growing the whole team as a team. Where last year, it was a little stagnant in our growth as a team. But not due to a lack of effort. There was just a lot of things working against us. And I'd say the new body, the new car with the Camaro last year put us behind. And then it was just hard to catch up with. As all of Chevy was behind, it was hard for us to get ourselves back in the right place, too. We feel like we've caught up, and now we're starting to get some advantages.
Yeah, and comparing, because you mentioned the new shop, and I know you mentioned that in Daytona, too. In comparison from last year, how close is the shop? Isn't it right near RCR this year?
Yeah, our shop is actually in the complex now. It's one of the buildings is actually the old Xfinity shop at RCR. Where our shop is now, we work out of there, and it's very close quarters. So where we used to have to spend a whole day to drive to RCR from Mooresville, now we can do it in just a couple hours. Not a couple hours, actually a couple minutes. So it just improves the communication, the way that we're able to work with them and be on the same page as them.
And how much have you been able to lean on Austin and Daniel?
A lot. You know, I think, you know, Daniel's a rookie, so he's learning from me and Austin quite a bit as well. But having two good, solid teammates, Daniel is one of the best teammates I've had as far as being able to break down a car and really get in-depth with what he's feeling. Now, a lot of times that really helps whether he's a rookie or not. He does a lot for the team and breaking down his car. That also helps us communicate what we need to our car. So, as a rookie, he's done an awesome job of just gelling right with the team, giving his honest information and feedback for what he feels our race cars need. And he's definitely helped us already. I mean, he's had some great runs at the mile and a half. They've had some bad luck this year, but he's going to get it going soon. And I think, you know, Austin and I have obviously worked together our whole lives and our whole careers. And just having another year of experience for me and for him and me in the Cup Series is always helpful. And, you know, I think that we are going to all continue to grow. We have a great group of talent and a lot of great people around us at RCR and Germain Racing.
Yeah, and the new shop's obviously a pretty big change. And like I said, you had a lot of optimism coming into the year. Now you got three top 15s in the first six races. What are some of the bigger changes that the team went through, you know, to start the year?
I think the biggest thing was starting a year off solid at Daytona, and making sure that we got out of there with a good finish. And the last couple of years, we left there almost last in points and had 0 points. And then when you go to Vegas and you go on this West Coast swing and you're trying to get your feet underneath you with your mile and a half program, especially when we had a new body style last year, we just struggled to get going. The second half of the year, we started getting strong again. But it just took us a while to get our legs back under. So when we left Daytona with a sixth-place finish, had a decent spot in the points, we were really happy, knowing that we could use the West Coast to develop this new package and kind of get an understanding, which we did. We had some growing pains out on the West Coast, but we feel like we've got a good head start and a good idea of what we need going forward. We still have to do some improvement at our mile and a half, but our short track program is ready to go, and we've been extremely competitive this year. So we've enjoyed this start to the year. We've had a couple races that we wish would have gone a little bit better, but we think we're going to be very capable of challenging to get into a chase spot this year and really compete.
All right, Ty, so we're taping this on Tuesday. A couple hours ago, NASCAR released the 2020 schedule. I want to get your take as a driver. Are you content with the changes, and which ones are you in favor of the most?
Yeah, I'm content with all the changes. I like every single one of them. I think NASCAR did a great job of really thinking through this schedule, putting out something really good that benefits the fans and the drivers and everybody involved in the sport. I think for me, I really like the 2 week straight break just for drivers and team members who have family that we can say, okay, this is a weekend that we can take off and go enjoy some time, get away from the sport, debrief a little bit, kind of relax, and be able to attack the second half of the season. I think the Pocono doubleheader is going to be extremely interesting. I think everybody is wondering what's going to happen with that. And that's going to be great for the sport too. But probably the most exciting thing is the way that the year is going to end in Daytona with a wild race. The regular season year is going to end in Daytona with a wild race. And then we have a Bristol race, the Charlotte Roval race, and Martinsville to be your cutoff races. I think they did a great job of gaining some variety in the chase and in the playoffs, and that's just going to be some great excitement. And then to change the Homestead Championship race to Phoenix, I think is a great thing, and I hope they continue to change the location of that last race year by year to give every state more action in our biggest event.
Yeah, in the five-year track agreements, you know, it's up after next year, meaning 2021 could even look different from next year. So is there any more you want to see be done? Or, I mean, you just mentioned the, you know, rotating the final race of the year. Is that something that you think NASCAR might should do? Maybe not every year, but every couple of years?
I do. I think maybe every 2 years, or I'm not against every year seeing something different, having a different race at the end of the year. I think it's just good for our sport and the awareness of our sport, and to take to these states and give them a little bit of taste of our biggest moment. And I think Homestead's done a great job of hosting it for the last, I don't know how many years.
I think it's 18.
But it's time for a little bit of change in that, and I think that it's going to be vastly welcomed by our fans. And I think we're going to see a lot of ticket sales go up going into 2020, especially with people having an idea of what's coming.
Yeah, we can only hope. And also, like you, I think the Pocono weekend's going to be crazy. But this week, we're heading to Texas. The new aero package is obviously in play. How do you think this race will play out this weekend for the number 13 team?
I think it's going to be a good weekend. Texas has probably been our strongest mile and a half race. I think we finished 13th there last year and had another top 20 run in the fall. And it's a place that we look at as one of our strongest mile and a half tracks. And definitely coming off of a 13th place finish at Martinsville, we want to keep that momentum going as a team. And so we're looking to capitalize off that and keep the good times rolling with our Geico Germain Racing team. And we think that this year, like I said, is going to be our best year yet.
Yeah, and before the year started, you were confident this package was going to help the 13 team, bringing you guys even closer to the bigger teams. So far, I know it's only been used in full effect a couple times, but do you feel that way as a driver still?
Yeah, I do. You know, I think you look at some of these races and we didn't start out as strong as we wanted to at Atlanta and Vegas. But by the end of the races, when we got the car dialed in a little bit better, we were competing with the Hendrix and some of the Joe Gibbs cars at in the top 10. Even though we were a lap down, we had that kind of speed at the end of the races. So that gives us hope. If we can do the small things right going into these races, that we'll have an opportunity to excel and do really well.
Now, Ty, I'll get you out of here on this one. Restarts have been insane this year. We've seen it in Vegas, Phoenix, Montana. You could throw in Atlanta. Now, since the repave at Texas, it's pretty much been a one-lane groove going into turn one. So how crucial and what kind of restarts do you think we'll see this weekend?
I think we're going to see some wild restarts going into turn one. I think it's going to be a little bit crazy trying to see everybody file in turn three. But you never know. And I think that's what's been cool about this package this year. We, even us drivers, don't know what we're going to see. And we just know we're going to see some chaos. Texas is going to be a little bit different because three and four is so wide open and has so much grip. And then one and two with this package is not going to be wide open. So to us, we're kind of approaching it right now as a one-turn racetrack. And see if... And just focus on making our car be the best in turn one and two, because we're pretty sure everyone's going to be wide open in three and four.
Well, cool, Ty. Appreciate your time and good luck this weekend at Texas.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me on.
All right, everyone. Ty has done a really good job to start off the 2019 season with Germain Racing. Last year, they didn't get their third top 15 finish until the July Daytona race, where he finished sixth. Also finished sixth this year in the Daytona 500. And that just goes to show that the hard work of Germain Racing over the offseason is indeed paying off. And many thanks to him for joining the show this week. But that was truly another fun episode with Neff. Obviously, last week, listening along, we spent a long time on Kyle Busch's and Richard Petty's 200 victories. And this week on the 2020 schedule, as NASCAR truly is shaking it up next year. But that's a wrap for this week, folks. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. And until next week... We out.